Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Mary Walter sitting in with Brian. I hope everyone is having a good day so far. And I hope you have a good day for the rest of the day, too, right? Got to keep your fingers crossed. We have so much going on the show. I want to start off right here, right now, with Christopher Tremoli. He's the editor and commentary writer for the Washington Examiner. You can find him on X at Chris W. Tremo. Chris, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. How are you?
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for having me. Happy Monday to you.
Thank you. You as well. So you were at the Trump rally in Philadelphia. I have yet to make it to a Trump rally, and that's probably because I'm claustrophobic, so I don't like a lot of people like crowding in. Even though I know like there'll never be a stampede, I still have that fear in the back of my brain. So how was it? What was it like? I want to hear all about it.
Right. Well, I got to cover the Trump rally for the Washington Examiner, and it was everything as one could imagine at a Trump rally. Everything was great. A lot of energy, what you could see, was in the crowd. And Trump brought home a lot of the points that he wanted to make during his presidential campaign, covering things from illegal immigration to election security to many of the social and cultural issues that are important that are making a way on today's political stand in presidential campaigns.
So one of the things that I hear people saying and somewhat complaining about is that it's the same speech all the time. He says the same things. He talks about the snake story every time, you know, the same jokes, which it's hard to always have new material. But I would think with Joe Biden, you can always have new material. Was it a little bit of a refreshed up version?
Well, I mean, that kind of goes on with everything. I mean, even if you listen to, I mean, how many times for anyone to really say that? And to not know what Joe Biden does when he repeats himself all the time, I think it's kind of a disingenuous commentary. So there were obviously themes in, that were repeated, but that's just par for the course. I mean, and that goes back as far as, you know, every presidential candidate speaking as I could ever imagine throughout my life. So that's not something distinct to Trump. So I would dismiss that at all. That's just people being angry and trying to find anything they can to grasp at straws and criticize Trump. For something that every other politician does the same as well.
I think also with the advent of social media, people in, you know, Montana are hearing his speech in Philadelphia or hearing bits and pieces of it, right? And if they didn't sit down and listen to it or watch it, they didn't consume it in that way, they're still exposed to it in a way that maybe we weren't 10 years ago even. So it's changing so quickly. That probably has a lot to do with it as well. So I want to ask you about the arena. I have a lot of logistics questions here because I saw all over social media, oh, look, he didn't even fill the arena. Is that true?
There were, There were top level, you know, sections in the LaCroix Center that weren't open, and that's kind of was on social media and whatnot. But the point is, the whole thing required, there was like a 10,000 ticket allotment, 10,000 some change. I don't remember what it was off the top of my head. And to everything that I researched and studied and tried to find on there suggested that all the tickets were taken up. So I don't know how many people were there. Total. I do know as for some arena that held 10,000, I mean, I would say that at bare minimum, it was 90% filled. I would, because what one thing they don't take into consideration when they do that is, yes, there's for a game that's, I don't know if you're familiar with the LaCroix Center, it's where Temple University men's basketball team plays.
Yes, I've been there.
So you're familiar. So in this, when you have the stands there, that the you basically have people sitting in the stands, but they're not sitting on the court as during a rally when there were people sitting on what would be the court during the game. So you could legitimately say that the 10,000 people or the people that were not seated in the upper sections there were actually on the court. So overall, like I said, to my knowledge, it was supposed to fill 10,000 people around there were supposed to have ticketed. And it seems that there were 10,000 people. I mean, I would be lying if I said I took my finger and counted everyone you would see on television. But, I mean, it doesn't matter, I would think, because there's just thousands of people went to show up to Trump's rally. And the most important part of it, you know, whether there was one or whether it was 10,000 people in attendance, is that Trump having this rally was historical because he held it in a predominantly black neighborhood and in Philadelphia. And this might have legitimately been the first time a Republican did this since Abe Lincoln. But to actually have this I track back 50 years in what I was looking into, and it could even be and probably is even beyond 50 years. But I couldn't find any other time when during a presidential campaign they went into a predominantly black neighborhood in Philadelphia.
And I'm so glad to see the campaign doing this. When they went into – so I want to ask you this, though, about that, because I was going to ask you. You read my mind. I was going to ask you. So was it attended by locals?
Define locals. It was people from all around. It wasn't – I would say that there probably wasn't the majority of – North Philadelphians attending the rally. But I also think that that's to be expected to go in and to say that, oh, you're going to hold a rally and that you would expect, everyone from the area to come in, especially given the whole, brainwashing and indoctrination that the left has had and the Democrats have had on, non-white and minority communities in this country. It would be unrealistic to expect that all of a sudden it would just flip on a switch, and that a lot of people have used it as criticism to say, oh, see, people aren't coming to see Trump. He's holding it in these black communities, and it's mostly like white people. But the thing is, change doesn't happen overnight, and this is the first time a Republican presidential candidate has legitimately made efforts to go into black communities to try to earn their vote. What I wanted to say before is like the only thing I could find in my research that any time a Republican president had gone into North Philly was July 2001 when George W. Bush attended a July 4th event in Philadelphia. And he attended a church event that was where Herb Lusk was the pastor. Herb Lusk was a former Eagles running back, was a famous pastor in North Philadelphia. Other than that, I couldn't find anything in which, and that wasn't even during a campaign. That was during a July 4th event. So I couldn't find anything which a Republican presidential candidate were going into these communities. So for people to kind of criticize him and try to say that, he didn't do this, it backfired, he didn't get it. Nothing changes overnight. And, maybe he didn't have it now, but give it time. And if this keeps on happening, Republicans keep on doing it, it definitely will change.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So did you, tell me what it's like, have you ever been to a Trump rally before?
So I had been to a Trump speech at the Moms for Liberty Summit last year.
Okay.
That was probably the first time, the only time I've ever seen him in person speak. So yeah, that was the last time and only time.
Right. So this is different. This was a rally. What were the people saying? I assumed you talked to people both inside and outside. Did you get to talk to people on the street who weren't going to the rally, asking them, what do you think about it, all of this? The people that Trump is trying to reach, like you said, by going into neighborhoods that traditionally vote Democrat, right? People of color, black and minority neighborhoods. I know that area. And although it is starting to turn around a little bit. These are the people that keep voting Democrat, 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 and then complain that nothing's ever happening. But I'm wondering if like the influx of illegals come because they're put in their neighborhoods. They see them getting services they're not getting. I wonder if, and now here comes Donald Trump. Does that open a door? Did you get to talk to anyone who said, yeah, this kind of opens a door for me?
I did not talk to anyone about that on Saturday. I have talked to people about that in the past, especially in Philadelphia. And I would say that the attitude is changing. There is a specific hold still with the Democrats. And I would say that's, I don't know nationwide, but definitely in Philadelphia, and it's completely inexplicable. I mean, that goes back to even their recent local elections with their district attorney, Larry Krasner, with Democrats, you know, and Philadelphians voted for him overwhelmingly. But and that's inexplicable. So it would be remiss to say that, you know, everything that's happening and Trump going on is making an immediate impact, that it's just causing this great shift. And I would say for that to happen would be unrealistic to legitimately expect that to happen. But the fact that it is making an impact at all and it is changing, you see some of the public opinion polls with the black vote and the Hispanic vote, and it's not as firmly entrenched in supporting Biden as it was in 2020. So whether it's, you know, Biden's failures as president or probably more realistically Trump's active pursuit of, you know, trying to appeal to everyone in this country, that I think is making a big difference. And that was one of the things, if you watch the rally, he said that, you know, he's for all Americans, the race didn't matter. And I think that's an important message that Trump has been reinforcing since he's been on the campaign trail and you know, his 2024 campaign.
Yeah, he seems to be campaigning very smart, always did. It seems to be a different version of Trump, which I do like. It seems to be a little bit more subdued, which I think is good. I think he's going to handle it well. And we'll see on Thursday night. We'll find out if it's a different Trump. Christopher Tremolia, thank you so much for joining us. You can find him, Chris W. Tremo, also at the Washington Examiner. Thank you. Have a fantastic day.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
All right, I want to talk to you. All right, we're going to talk about the debate, and I want to know from you, when it comes to the debate, how do you think this is going to go? I'm just curious. We're just going to spitball. We're going to Monday morning quarterback. We're just going to sit here. We're going to say, this is what I think is going to happen, and are you interested in it? Because I got to tell you, I'm a little disappointed, but I'll tell you why coming up, all right? 866-408-7669. I'm Mary Walter, in for Brian Kilmeade on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Now, for President Biden, one more piece of advice, because this is still a physical, visual medium, right? He's kind of got resting old face, right? So you need him to.
Point out.
I'm learning so much. The bars in hell, resting old face.
And so he needs to smile, and when he smiles, it goes away a little bit. Because when he smiles, his face comes alive. I would just say, if they're practicing this, practice smiling.
That was Jamal Simmons on CNN. I'm Mary Walter sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. You can join me at 866-408-7669, or you can reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. So here's my thing about the upcoming debate on Thursday. The bar is so low for Joe Biden, and you've probably heard this over and over again, but it's really true. If Joe Biden manages to stand for 90 minutes, people are going to say he won the debate. And here's the thing. When I said we went into the break, I said I'm not super thrilled about this, because it's really not a debate. They're really just answering questions from Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. They're not going to go at it. They're not going to get into it with each other. Not that I want to see a brawl. I get annoyed when they just talk over each other and you can't hear them. That to me doesn't serve any purpose. But, you know, like during Trump and when Trump and Hillary debated, that was such a great debate. Because it was, you know, she said something, he goes, wrong. He just says it into the microphone. Or I forget what she said about how things would be different. He goes, yeah, you'd be in jail. You know, like there was a lot more that, and Joe Biden can't do that. He just can't do that. So I think the bar is so low for Joe that Joe wins this no matter what. The questions, you know, are going to be all about topics that Biden, you know, does well on, like abortion, etc. There'll probably be some questions about immigration. But here's the other thing. I think if they hit a lot of topics that Joe's really weak on, economy, inflation, things where he's going to lie, they're going to, I think they're going to try to goad Trump into trying to yell at Joe and the microphone's off and there's Trump just, you know, fuming. I hope he keeps his cool. If Trump keeps his cool, I think he will do really well in this debate. Of course, I'm going to be listening and watching. Absolutely. And I recommend that you listen to part of it and not watch it, and then watch part of it, because it's a totally, you're going to walk away with a totally different take if when you listen versus when you watch, because you don't see the facial expressions. It's so different when you see facial expressions and body language. You may walk away with a totally, totally different take on it. I want to go to Cut 25. This is Charlemagne the God, and this is on his Brilliant Idiots podcast, and he claims that Biden won't be able to keep up at the debate.
Do you not want Trump to be interrupted? So you're thinking about it one way. Oh, you're just going to let Trump go? And you can't jump in? And you 80 plus years old and trying to keep up with every single lie he's going to lay out? Are you serious?
You got a point there.
Biden's not going to be able to keep up.
It's going to be bad.
It's going to be bad.
The other thing I want to ask you is, it is interesting that the Democrats are the ones who threw out the gauntlet with a debate. Trump kept asking for it. Finally, they said, okay, great. And they got to make all the rules, right? It's their playground. They get to pick the moderators. We'll do it, but we get to pick everything we want. We get everything we want. So they sent Trump. I knew, and we all know, Trump said, okay, that's fine. We'll do it your way, because that's Trump. He's not afraid of anything. And I like that about him. But I do think, and I think he's smart enough this time around, as I was just saying to our guest, Christopher Tremolia from Washington Examiner, he seems to be a different Trump this time around. And I think he got burned in the last debate when Chris Christie was prepping him, and he tried to get Angry Joe to come out. Now, I have a theory. Joe Biden, to me, when they pump him with the Joe juice, He becomes angry grandpa. He becomes angry. I'm keeping the ball if it comes in my yard. That's what he's yelling and pounding the podium, like the State of the Union address. And that speech in Philadelphia with the red background and the two soldiers, it was very, very, I don't know, authoritarian dictatorship looking. Well, not a good look. I don't know who chose that, but it was not a good look. But that's when he pounds the podium, right? And he gets very angry grandpa. If they've pumped him with so much Joe juice that he's angry grandpa, it's not going to be a good look for Joe. Although the left will say, look at it. Look at how vital, you know, he's so vigorous. Look at how young he is. You know, look at him. He was so lively. But it's going to be hard for Joe, because Joe can't really run on his record, because he can't run on inflation, right? He can't run on the economy because of inflation. So the only topics that are going to be good for Joe is really abortion. That's it, right? They try to paint Trump as a racist. Oh, Trump's a racist, but he's not going to be able to come up with anything specific that Trump's a racist about, right? You had Snopes just say that the fine people hoax in Charlottesville was actually just that. That's not really what Trump said. 7 years later, that's not what Trump said. And Joe Biden's campaign keeps repeating it. So the Trump campaign is now saying, hey, you're lying. Stop lying. I think the hardest part for Trump is going to be not jumping in. He's not going to be able to do that. So what do you think? Have Republicans set the bar too low for Biden? And what does Trump need to do? And I said, I think Trump needs to just let Joe be Joe. Just let him go. Let him self-destruct. And because I think if he doesn't have enough Joe juice, he just kind of slows down. And if he has too much Joe juice, he becomes angry. And it's just not a good look for him. All right, coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about what happened at the rally in Philadelphia before the rally in Philadelphia over the weekend, technically before. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. 866-408-7669 is my number, or you can reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. We were just talking about the debate on Thursday, and I just think it's going to be boring because there's going to be no interaction between the candidates, and I think so that part of it's going to be boring to me. I like to see it be a little bit lively. I just think the bar's so low for Joe Biden. He wins no matter what. Plus, he got to pick the moderators. And I'm sorry, but after the whole Donna Brazile thing, I don't trust that Joe's team doesn't have the answers, the questions. I just don't trust it. Sorry, but, you know, past behavior is sometimes prediction of future behavior. So, I don't know. They're kind of in the tank for Joe. So I don't think that that's necessarily a bridge too far. Quickly, let's go to Gregory in Virginia. He wants to talk about the debate. Gregory, welcome. You're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, Your Highness. I saw something on Twitter from Sean Spicer, and I would like to have Trump yield some of his time and ask Joe Biden a question. Please name the members of your cabinet. I think that would be delicious because I don't think he'd be able to do it.
That's great, but that'll never happen, right? They're not going to let Trump ask Biden a question.
Yeah, he could shout it into the other microphone. He's got a big voice, and I think they're going to hammer him really about COVID. I mean, and perhaps twist things about the Epiphany insurrection. What else is there to do? He's done tremendous things and has a litany of accomplishments, and Biden has nothing but failure.
Let me ask you, has this been done by the Democrats? Has this been set up by the Democrats? Because you've seen the signs, I think, in the media slowly. It's been a drip, drip, drip that Joe's not going to be the candidate. They're starting to shoot at their own, metaphorically, obviously. They usually circle the tents, and it's usually the Republicans that form the firing squad, right? But they seem to be allowing the media now to criticize Joe Biden and do it quite a bit. And so to me, that's a tell that I just don't know if Joe Biden is long for this campaign after this debate.
They could have planned this as the final failure in his regime. But I don't know who's next. Kamala? Good God.
No, Michelle Obama.
Michelle, oh, I like Mike. Yeah, right.
No, I think, Gregory, thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure. I just think that this is part of the long goodbye for Joe Biden. And I think at the end, it's going to be pretty swift. Out the door he goes. If he makes it through this debate and they declare him the winner, then no, he's the candidate. But if he doesn't make it through this debate, you know, they're pumping him up. They're doing everything they can. Supposedly, he's practicing standing for 90 minutes. It's, you know, walking out there, there's going to be a distinct difference in how they're viewed walking out. And I think it all depends on the Joe juice. So let's go back to Trump in Philadelphia. So he went to, before he went to the rally, he have to go to a cheesesteak restaurant in Philadelphia. Of course you do, right? So he went to one locally, Tony and Nick's Steaks. And while he was there, it was a huge crowd and everything. And the guy, one of the owners of the who owned Tony and Nick's Steaks, Nikki Lucidonio, said that a woman had come into his restaurant on Friday, and she told him she had a, quote, big order of about 200 sandwiches. I said, great, who's it for? She said, it's for some special people. That's all she would tell him. So very cool that they bought 200 cheesesteaks from the guy, too. I like that they do that, that the Trump campaign does that and, you know, handed out cheesesteaks to people and things like that. But while he was there, he did something that is catching fire. And I want to know if you've ever done this. While he was there, he's signing the bill. Trump's signing the bill. And on it, he writes, vote. He wrote, no tax on tips. And a lot of Trump supporters are doing that. They're writing, no tax, vote Trump, no tax on tips. because that's one of the things that he's promised. That's one of his campaign things now is, hey, we're going to stop taxing tips. So listen to this. A little hard to hear, but here he is very, you know, grandly making a big deal. There's a crowd around him, but you got a straight on shot of Donald Trump signing the bill. Here we go.
No tax on tips. Yeah.
So have you ever done that? Have you done that yet in a restaurant? Have you written? Because I always try to leave cash tips. I always try to leave cash just because in my brain, there was a movement a while ago by Rand Paul who said, when you tax somebody, when you tip somebody, give them cash and say that it's a gift because there's a no tax on gifts. You don't have to report gifts. It's a gift. It's not a tip. So I like to give them cash anyway, just because it goes in their pocket. They don't have to get, you know, paid out at the end of the day. And a lot of sometimes they'll take the, if it's on a credit card, they'll take some of the credit card fee out of that. So I like to give cash. But even if I give cash now, we're starting to write vote Trump, no tax on tips. So I'm curious if you have done that. Now, one of the other things he did during the rally, he vowed not. He made some vows during the rally, not just one, but a couple of different things he said when it comes to our schools, because our schools are out of control, our colleges and universities especially, and it's trickling down to the younger grades with all of this DEI nonsense and other things that they're forcing on these kids in this ideology. You know, they were all upset about the Ten Commandments in school. Like, they're all crazy about that as a religion. Like, yeah, but you know what? Okay. We'll take the ten. I can see getting rid of the Ten Commandments. That's fine. But no pride flags, no BLM nonsense, none of that. American flag, state flag, that's it. 866-408-7669. So here's cut six. This is Donald Trump with some vows of how he's going to treat schools under his administration.
And I will not give one penny to any school that has a vaccine mandate or a mask mandate. And I will keep men out of women's sports on day one. Signed.
Now, that last part there, I will give, I will keep men out of women's sports on day one. Signed. I love that, but I wish that they would couch it by saying, I am going to protect women so that men can't take their educational opportunities by seizing their scholarships, by competing in their sports. You know, he's protecting women because the left has this whole, we're protecting women's rights because you have the right to abortion. We're protecting women's rights, except for the baby girl you're aborting. But besides that, that's a great way to say, I'm going to protect women's rights. I'm going to protect your young girls and make sure that a man doesn't take her educational opportunities. I love that getting rid, you know, seriously, masks. Can we go back to where, you know, wearing masks at protests was illegal, that kind of thing? I still see people wearing masks, and I'm sorry, and maybe I'm wrong, but I get very judgy. I get very judgy when I see you wearing a mask. Now, if you're elderly, I'm like, okay, you're scared. Maybe you have some kind of disease, some kind of immune system issue. But other than that, and maybe if you look a little frail, if you're younger, I'm like, okay, you got something going on. But I just assume that you're very sick if you're outside wearing a mask now. I just, I don't know. And it makes me want to steer right away from you. I can't help it. And maybe that's a bad thing, but I'm just like, I'm not dealing with this. So I love that. Not one penny to schools that have vaccine and mask mandates. There are some schools that are still have COVID vaccine mandates if kids want to go to school there. It's insane. And keeping men out of women's sports. I love that. Let's go to Dayton, Ohio. Vivian, I'm listening on WHIO. Vivian, welcome. You're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hey, Mary. I just wanted to speak about the Trump rally. I am a Black American, and I think it's great for him to go into the Black community. We just recently had something here in Dayton, and they were talking about the millions of dollars that are brought into the community. And I think, you know, by Trump going down to that area, it probably brought some money and economic development. People probably stopped and bought something while they were down there. What you think?
Absolutely, especially food, right? Cheesesteaks, things like that. There were probably vendors there, people who were maybe a little bit, having a little bit of an entrepreneurial streak and said, oh, Trump's going to be doing this rally. And they went out and they got a bunch of t-shirts or whatever it happens to be, and they sold them at a markup. Good for them.
Amen. I agree.
Yeah, I love it. So I had read something, and since you lit off with I'm a Black American, we don't have a lot of time here, but I just want to quickly ask you that I saw something go across X, a video, and it was a black man with a Make America Great Again hat on, and he said that the black community is more on board with Trump than anybody realizes. They're just on the down low about it. They're very quiet about it, kind of like we all were in 2016 when everybody was very quiet about it. We were, you know, like you didn't know because you didn't know who was listening and you didn't know who your audience was, but that the black community is that way now in 2024, the way, I guess, the majority of Trump supporters were in 2016. Is that true?
I think so. Now, I had a talk with a young girl yesterday about 13, and her birthday is the same as Donald Trump, and she says she hated it. And I had to explain to her it's a good thing. And I tell everybody, when under Joe Biden, I had to get a job. I'm 68. I hadn't worked in 6 years. Under Trump, I got a stimulus check. Figure it out. So I would not wear my Trump t-shirt. I would not wear my Trump hat. I would not put a Trump sticker on my car.
Right.
Okay.
No, I would not put a Trump sticker on my car either because I really don't want to have it repainted. Vivian, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it. And keep educating, you know, keep saying things to people. I give you a lot of credit for that, especially the younger set. Thank you so much for joining me. More coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. If you want to join me, 866-408-7669. You can reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. I'll try to get your comments. Try to multitask and do it both. Do it all. While in Philadelphia, Tony and Nick's Steaks by Temple University on Saturday, there was a young man in a blue suit, a white shirt, a red tie, and he had on a blonde Donald Trump wig or Joy Reid wig. It's the same thing. You ever notice Joy Reid wears Donald Trump's hair? It's to me one of the funniest. Every time I see it, I just laugh. I'm like, you hate him so much, yet you wear his hair. And of course, you know, he got in, and of course he was seen by everyone. And the audio is hard to hear, so I'm just going to tell you what happened. So Donald Trump sees him and, of course, makes a big deal out of the kid. Donald Trump's had kids. He's great with kids. And he says to the kid, he pulls out $20 out of his pocket. He pulls out a $20 bill, Trump does. And he shows it to the kid and he says, you know who that is? That's Andrew Jackson. And then he takes it over to a counter. Trump does, and he pulls out a Sharpie. And he says, you know what? We're going to add some value. And he signs the picture. This kid is standing there and he's crying. He's so just enamored with Donald Trump. And then they have a picture together and the kid's all excited. He's got a picture holding the $20 bill. And then Trump said to him, he said, I like that kid. He goes, I like this kid. I like that kid. And he looks at the kid. He goes, if your parents don't want you, I'll take you. But this kid, it was so, he's such a young kid, and he just was so enamored with Donald Trump. And there's a picture of him holding this $20 bill. You could see this, where the tears were on his face. His face is all wet. It was just really endearing. All right. Okay. Let's talking about Trump still, but talking about the New York case. So much going on in the news. It's crazy, but a lot of it, of course, is Trump centric. This is another, we were just talking about the debate, and this to me is yet another signal that the word has gone out that it is time to get rid of Joe. Andrew Cuomo was on with Bill Maher and they were talking about the case. Now, this could also be the way that Andrew Cuomo tries to revive his standing in the Democrat Party. I don't know, but listen to the exchange here.
That case, the Attorney General's case in New York, frankly, should have never been brought. And if his name was not Donald Trump, and if he wasn't running for president, I'm the former AG in New York, I'm telling you that case would have never been brought. And that's what is offensive to people. And it should be, because If there's anything left, it's belief in the justice system.
What is Cuomo's angle, right? What is Cuomo's angle? Because usually the Democrats walk in lockstep. They're not doing that anymore. Something's afoot, people. I'm telling you, something's afoot. I don't know what it is, but something's happening on the Democrat side. Now, this not as much. Judge Judith Sheinland, better known as Judge Judy, she was on with CNN's Chris Wallace Friday. And she's not a Trump fan at all. She does not like him at all. She had backed Nikki Haley, who, of course, dropped out of the race. But here she's talking about the same thing, talking about Alvin Bragg and the case that was brought against Trump.
I would be happier as someone who owns property in Manhattan if the district attorney of New York County would take care of criminals who are making it impossible for citizens to walk in the streets and use the subway, to use his efforts to keep those people off the street, than to spend $5 million or $10 million of taxpayers' money trying Donald Trump on this nonsense.
She called it nonsense. She said of Bragg, you had to twist yourself into a pretzel to figure out what the crime was. It's just he just doesn't like Trump. And she did go on to say, I didn't think that Donald should ever have been president. And I don't think that even though Donald thought he was going to, and I don't think that even Donald thought he was going to be president. So something's up. And like I said, I don't quite get what it is. I don't know what's, I just don't know what's happening. And we have the debate, et cetera, coming up. And, obviously, like I said, you should watch part of it, and you should also probably, listen to part of it. Do the two. Turn the TV off and just listen to it. Quickly, Jerry Seinfeld, I don't know if you saw this, Jerry Seinfeld was performing in Australia, and he got heckled by an anti-Semitic heckler. And Jerry Seinfeld took the guy down. It was absolutely masterful. He said to him, I think you need to go back and tell whoever's running your organization we just gave more money to a Jew. Because the guy's chanting, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And I love it. And I love that Jerry Seinfeld, first of all, can I just say, it is to me absolutely outrageous that this is happening, this blatant anti-Semitism, like at a Jerry Seinfeld show, people jump up and say that totally anti-Semitism. They feel comfortable enough to shout that. He went on to say that this can't be a good plan for you. You got to come up with a better plan. So of course they all wind up being taken out. He said, you have strong political feelings, but you don't know where to say them. You think that ruining the night, it doesn't affect me. All these people, you're ruining their night. And he's right. So good for him. But the fact that people are so comfortable with anti-Semitism is really scary. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. Hope everyone is having a fantastic day. Joining us later this hour is Charles Horan. He is the president of the Log Cabin Republicans. And they have an event coming up with former First Lady Melania Trump. Find out about that. Joining us right now, Michael Goodwin of the New York Post. Michael, he has a piece out right now on Joe Biden's a one-trick pony with only one act, and he blames Donald Trump. This is a great piece, Michael Goodwin, one of my favorites. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hello.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you.
I always enjoy speaking with you. You hit the nail on the head in this piece. Joe Biden's a one-trick pony with a single act, blame Donald Trump. And it's so true. And you lay it out beautifully. You know, all they do is he can't run on anything. We were talking, you know, we talk about this a lot, how he can't run on the economy, right? It's the economy stupid. Well, he can't run on that. He can't run on immigration. The only thing he can run on is abortion, and Donald Trump's a bad person. How does that win a campaign? Does it?
Well, it would seem to be a real long shot, but as you say, he has no fallback position. He can't really say, I'm going to do X in the future, because if he didn't do anything in 4 years on X, it's hard to believe he'll do it again. And he has failed at so many big issues. I mean, the border, of course, the economy, the world is on fire. The whole inflation issue still ripples through the economy and still drives up a lot of prices, and people feel that. I mean, and so when you have real wages falling, meaning even if you got a raise, if you haven't kept pace with inflation, you're effectively making less. You have less purchasing power. And so all of those things are on his record. So what can he say except Donald Trump is no good? Donald Trump is a convicted felon, January 6th, threat to democracy, blah, blah, blah. It may work with some people, but I think most people feel that their own lives come first. They don't feel Donald Trump in their lives. Right now, they feel Joe Biden's policies in their lives, and that's why he's got these very, very low approval ratings.
So look ahead to Thursday to the debate. What are we going to see them discuss? Because the vast majority, as you just said, of topics are losers for Joe Biden. The only thing he can do is lie. Right. He can only, inflation was 9% when I came into office. And Donald Trump can't say lie. Like, he can't say that wrong. He can't do that. So what are the questions going to be? How are they going to really push this in Joe Biden's favor, other than ask questions like, Donald Trump's a dictator, isn't he? How are they going to do it?
Yeah. What kind of dictator would he be, do you think, Joe?
Exactly.
Would he be a benign dictator, a nasty dictator? I think you put your finger on it there, Mary, that the questions will be loaded, and they will all favor Joe Biden's argument. So it's really a challenge for Donald Trump how he handles this. And I'm not sure what his plan is. It's not an obvious situation where you can just turn it back, because particularly with this rule that the microphone will shut off when it's not your time. So it's going to be very hard to, I think, interject any counter thoughts that would change the tone of the argument. So I think this is going to be a moderator's debate. And, you know, I encourage people to watch the YouTube version of the second 2020 debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Donald Trump was actually much better than I even remembered him. He was calmer, more concise. He didn't interrupt as much as he did in the first debate by a long shot. But what you can also see is the power of the moderator. And in this case, it was Kristen Welker from NBC. And I don't think she was overtly trying to help Biden so much as she became a captive of the clock. And so anytime there would be an actual debate between the candidates, she would jump in and say, we've got to move on to the next question. And so the power of the moderator is to stop debates before the public can get any clear idea of a contrast other than an insult. I mean, they'll insult each other, but that doesn't really tell you much. For the undecided voters and for the persuadable voters who are weakly attached to one candidate or another, it's the depth of the debate, I think, that is what they want. And my fear is we won't get that because the moderators will be eager to, in this case especially, to let Biden and to echo Biden's charges against Trump and put Trump on the defensive all night. That, I think, is going to be the challenge for him in this debate.
But I, to your point, is it really a debate, or is this just each one of them answering questions? You know, it's basically an interview because they can't interact.
That's right. It's just a serial interview, back and forth, different, same or different questions, but it doesn't really allow them the time to have a debate where you throw out a topic and you say, I'm going to let it go. As long as it's civil, as long as it's coherent and we can understand it, I'm going to let it go for 4 minutes or three. They just don't do that. And I think if you look historically at these presidential debates, the time, it's gotten faster and faster. There's no time for a detailed answer. And it's become just an insult machine. And I blame the moderators. I think the moderators have gotten overly aggressive and inflexible. They have a list of questions. They're going to get to all of them. And that is what I think turns it just into these serial interviews, quick answers without any backup. And this is the presidency. I think we could do with fewer questions and longer answers, as long as it's a legitimate answer and not just filibustering.
Yeah, well, it's as you said, it is going to be very interesting. I just want to quickly get to Kamala Harris, who was on MSNBC this morning with Mika Brzezinski. I wish we had more time. But the one thing they do have to talk about is abortion. So here is Kamala Harris, of course, jumping on the abortion issue, and of course, Mika giving her, you know, the platform to go with their one topic. Oh, cut 30.
And I will point to, just look at what happened in the midterms, for example. Many talked about the red wave.
Mm-hmm.
I would call it a red drip.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at where the American people were in so-called red states and so-called blue states, every time this issue of abortion was on the ballot, the people voted for freedom. That's who the American people are, right? We have our differences, but the American people believe in the integrity of our country and our values, which include that we protect and fight for individual freedoms and liberties. And so I do believe that the contrast is clear, and in November it will be stark.
All I can say, Michael, is can you imagine listening to that for 4 years as the president?
I think her answer there is, she enlarges the point, of course. She makes it sound like it's more than just abortion. It's not. It's just abortion. And Trump, I think, has adapted to the post-Roe world and talks about the states and talks about exceptions, even in states that want to have limits, that there must be exceptions for the health of the mother, et cetera. So I think he has been adjusting for some time on this issue. I'm sure, as you say, it will be a big topic on Thursday night. It's better ground for Democrats than it is Republicans nationally. But again, I think this is one where the President Trump's answer will go a long way to either inflaming the issue or diffusing it.
Yeah, and he does seem to your point, have really practiced. Look, it went back to the states. You have more control now, and that's going to be the answer, which is what it should be, is don't take the bait of their lies. Just tell the truth. You have more control now. It's back to the states. I want to get into a little bit more of Kamala and Mika Brzezinski here. This is Cut 10, Vice President Kamala Harris.
Donald Trump says he connects with black voters now, especially because of his felony conviction. He also says that he's not a racist because he has a lot of black friends.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
Well, on the first point, as connected to the second point, it's insulting.
Yeah.
It's insulting for a number of reasons, including he has reduced a whole population of people down to a sum total of what is in his mind who they are. And he's wrong. And he's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. He's wrong. Yeah. The two of them.
The Democrats who have done that. It's the Democrats who are skin obsessed, color obsessed, ethnicity obsessed, gender obsessed. They should be worried. The Democrats should be worried about the black vote. If you just look at some recent events of Donald Trump's, he had the South Bronx rally. He had a rally in Detroit, had a rally in Philadelphia, in Temple, in the inner city, at Temple University. He is clearly making a play for the black vote. And as he and others have noted, the Democratic Party has taken the black vote for granted. If you talk to black conservatives about the Democratic Party, it is that, you know, they come around every 4 years wanting votes, and what they promise is essentially more welfare, more government programs, but they are not the party of opportunity. They're not the party of a dynamic economy. They are the party of government handouts, and that's what they promise, and special carve-outs and preferences, et cetera. Look, there's no question there's a segment of the black population that responds to that. But increasingly, as people look around, I think they're seeing this is a dead end. You're not really addressing the lack of opportunity we feel, or you're not addressing the issues of crime, which are rampant in most black communities, in especially urban areas, and you're coddling the criminals. You're not taking care of the innocent victims. You're not protecting us. And so I think there is an open space for Donald Trump and other Republicans. You're seeing it from black conservative commentators. Yeah. And I think there is an argument here. Look, I think America is better when every group is being fought over by both parties. Whoever you are, wherever you live, whatever your background, your ethnicity, your race, your religion, your income levels, it's good if both parties are fighting for your vote. That's yes. better for the country, and it's better for you. And so I think that the monopoly, the near monopoly that Democrats have had on black voters
yes.
is not good for the country. And it has not been good for black no. voters by and large.
Yeah. Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist, thank you so much for joining me. His latest article, Joe Biden is a one-trick pony with a single act, blame Donald Trump. You can find him on X at @mgoodwin_NYPost. Thank you so much for joining me, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary.
Your calls and more coming up on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And I'm Mary Walters, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. 866-408-7669 is my number. Let's head out to Long Island. Bill listening on WABC. Bill, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, how are you? I have a question. I'm just curious, and I wonder why a seasoned politician needs 6 days to rehearse for a debate while it doesn't make any sense to me. He's a seasoned politician, 50 years in politics?
It's an excellent point. You're absolutely right, Bill. I've heard a lot of people talk about what he's going to do, but I haven't heard anyone ask that question, like, put it the way you did. This dude's been in politics forever. why does he need a week? But he's literally, from what we understand, practicing standing for 90 minutes. That's hard for somebody his age. Listen, I don't have a problem if you have physical infirmities. I'm fine with that as long as your brain is working. I don't care, right? Like, that's okay with me. But if it's the brain I worry about. So if he needs to sit for 90 minutes, that's fine as long as he's sharp at his attack, but he's not. And that's the problem.
Yeah, but if he sits down, he might fall asleep.
I just had this mental image of him sitting down and just kind of like falling asleep and slowly like melting into the chair and sliding under the desk.
You got it, man. Thanks for asking
it. Bill, that's a great question. Thank you so much for joining me on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Yeah, I want to say, so I think part of it, again, as I said earlier, I don't trust CNN because of the whole Donna Brazile thing with Hillary Clinton, so I don't trust them. I believe there's probably a lot of prepping him. Okay, this is the question, because whenever he takes questions from the press, he has a cheat card, right? His little card. And it not only has the name of the reporter, it has the reporter's picture on there as well, right? So it's got the reporter's picture, the reporter's name, it has the question that's going to be read to him, and then it has his answer printed out for him. But one of the things they're not allowed to do, and I think this is great, is that they're not allowed to have any papers with anything printed in front of them on the podium or on their podiums. They're doing podiums. So not on the podium. So they have like a pen, paper, water, that's it. So he can't have notes in front of him, and that's going to be tough for Joe. I don't think anybody has the ability to memorize the answers to all the questions if they got them. If they got the questions in advance, I don't think anybody has the ability to memorize all of them in a week. You can prep, you know, and get your answers. Okay, what do you say about abortion? What do you say about this? Economy, inflation. You have that ability. I don't know if Joe has that ability. Even if he's on the Joe juice, I don't know if he has that ability. So I think it's going to be a wild card. That part of it's going to be interesting. And the reason they turn the microphones off is so that Trump can't interrupt him. Because if Trump interrupts him, it throws Joe off. So that's not in play here. You know, that's not going to be a problem. So not in play. I would like to welcome a new affiliate, KAOI News Talk Sports from Maui and beyond at 1110 AM and 96.7 FM. Welcome to the family. Coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show, Charles Moran, president of the Log Cabin Republicans, will be joining us. Talk about another group that is often stereotyped as Democrat voters, but maybe they're not, on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're just joining me, I'm Mary Walters, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. Joining us now is Charles Moran. He is the president of the Log Cabin Republicans. Find him on X at Charles T. Moran, M-O-R-A-N. Charles, welcome to the show. Great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me on today.
Absolutely. So my question to you is, if you don't vote for Biden, you ain't gay.
That's the logic that they use these days over there. But I think they're quickly realizing that they're earning a smaller and smaller share of Black Americans, Latinos, gays, Asians. The way we talk about it in the coalition's world is, it doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Christian or Black or gay or Latino, we are all equally getting screwed by Joe Biden and this administration.
Exactly.
And, it's misery loves company, something like that.
Yeah. So you did an interview with Fox News Digital, and one of the things I got from it is something that I have said for so long. I am so tired of being a Black American. Gay American, fill in the blank American. Why can't we just all be Americans? Like, I'm so tired of it. And I've noticed this year in particular, I think like the whole pride thing has not been shoved down my throat to the extent that it has been in the past. Like, everywhere I go, I don't have to bow to a rainbow. You know what I mean? Like, I'm actually allowed to drive across a rainbow flag painted on a street. Although there are, what, two guys, three kids who are like being charged because they, you know, popped wheelies or whatever they did. Oh, they made the black marks with the tires on the pride flag that was painted somewhere. There seems to be a calming down of this. And I think it's because, to your point just now, Black Americans want to be known as more than just that. Gay Americans, lesbian Americans, whatever you fall in the alphabet there, they want to be more for the most part than just that. They want to just be Americans. Your concerns are the same as everybody else's, right?
And this is just something that I think more and more Americans are seeing, and they've watched it over the last 4 years, that this administration has just been driving an ever-increasing frantic pace of intersectionality and identity politics. You know, again, we are facing wars overseas, looming battles, you know, rising inflation, declining economic returns, and they care more about pronoun usage, you know, pandering to these different communities to try to get electoral votes. And I think people are just kind of tired of it. I mean, to your even point now about those folks being prosecuted for doing wheelies over, you know, their painted rainbow intersection. But it's evidently okay, and it's free speech if people climb up in Washington, D.C. or New York and spray paint, you know, over George Washington monuments or Thomas Jefferson monuments, you know, at a pro-Palestine protest. I mean, people are literally watching this on their screens, on their phones, on the TV, and they're saying this is just rank hypocrisy. But this is where Democrats are. It's not about what happens. It's about how you interpret it. And there is no, you know, there's no unified rule of law here. And to your point about people being taken for granted, and I love being able to have these conversations in a little bit of a long form interview and not having to do this in sound bites on TV, is that I think, you know, it's a political election year, and Democrats and Republicans are equally accused of, you know, sliding into these communities every 4 years and saying, hey, you know, blacks, Latinos, whatever, you all, you know, we're here, we're listening to you after not for 3 years. You know, let's set up these coalitions, let's put these steering committees together, is a rank attempt to just get votes and raise money. And yeah. Then the campaign ends and then they go away. And, you know, and it's a lot of it's identity politics. Democrats obviously play that game very well. And then when we as Republicans try to do it, we do it, but we don't really do it very well. And that's because we know it doesn't work. And this is one of the things that we've started to explore in, you know, in our conservative circles. And it was really prompted at Melania Trump's you know, in request, and she kind of threw this out there, and, you know, she hosted an event for us at Mar-a-Lago in April of this year, and it was around that very theme that you just touched upon. It was this whole unity. We need to be leaning into our future, our togetherness in a unified fashion. It doesn't, you know, let's get rid of the hyphenations and let's really focus on the things that bring us together. And that's not to say that there is no need for organizations like mine. We've still got to have authentic messages with trusted messengers. So that's why groups like Log Cabin are still very important, because there is about, in the last election, a third of all gays voted for Republicans and Donald Trump. And we're, you know, our polling shows that that number could, we're going to get knocking on the door 50% in this election cycle. So it's not to say there's not opportunities, because the GOP needs to go out and hit and identify all of these different demographics and use whatever language they speak in and whatever values they hold and connect those back to us as conservatives, small c conservatives. So, but to your point, and Mrs. Trump really has emphasized this, this unity around our American spirit, about why people choose to be in America, why we celebrate liberty and freedom. These are the things we need to lean into, because the situations in the world are so dire and it's hitting people. I mean, the Democrats can put out all of these economic indicators and facts all they want about how things are getting better. But at the end of the day, people are still going to the grocery store and they're coming home with less, with the same amount of money that they were putting in. And Americans know.
I feel like that person goes, well, I have a gay friend, but I live in New Jersey. We have a lot of gay and lesbian friends, right? And I have some friends who are transgendered, and everybody's fine. We all get along. And some are conservative and some aren't. But the bottom line is they all work. They all have jobs. They buy, like you were just saying, they go to the grocery store and they're complaining about the prices, right? And so to the Democrat ones, I'm like, well, you know, you might want to fix that in November. But the ones who are conservative, it's sad because they have been outed from their friends groups over the years. Like, they slowly were just not invited at the last election cycle. They were not invited to parties anymore. And I feel badly for them. And they've had to realign their friends groups, which I think happens to a lot of people. But to me, what the gay community that is conservative, the thing they can latch onto is this whole Queers for Palestine thing. Do people, do they literally are ignorant. They honestly don't know that if we took a busload of you want to go to Gaza, let's go to Gaza, and you take them to Gaza, they're not going to last 24 hours because they will be murdered for what they believe in, but take them to Israel, murdered for who they are. Take them to Israel and they're allowed to be who they want to be. The ignorance is so thick.
It is astounding, and I think that we're really hitting a watershed moment where, and we've been going through this since 2016. I mean, in 2016, you know, the left-wing gay groups, what we call Gay Inc., was, of course, they were all in for Hillary Clinton, and how could you not support her? And
right.
People really started to actually challenge them, like, look, you've got a candidate in Donald Trump. Do not forget that he was, you know, he has a long history of supporting LGBT equality as a businessman and as a philanthropist, and then as president of the United States and an elected official. You know, he speaks publicly about his friendship with people who were part of our community back in the 80s and how HIV/AIDS decimated, you know, our community, and how many of his friends who were talented doctors and lawyers and artisans and designers whose lives were lost. And he was one of the first people to write a six-figure check to the Elizabeth Taylor AIDS Foundation before it was popular to do HIV/AIDS fundraising. And then as a businessman, he instituted domestic partnership and, you know, health benefits and whatnot for same-sex spouses before it was even required by the law in the state of New York. So again, as a philanthropist, as a businessman, he's been there for equality, and it's no surprise that as president of the United States, again, first president ever elected in history that supported marriage equality when elected, having initiatives like ending the spread of HIV/AIDS in 10 years, going to the United Nations and calling upon the world to decriminalize homosexuality. You were just talking about what's going on in the Middle East. At the time, there was over 70 countries that criminalized homosexuality in some way, shape, or form, including 9 that would kill you for it. And now we see actually across the world, you know, things got better when Donald Trump was president because he would use, you know, as we saw, economic forces to encourage good behavior. We've seen that pressure go away under Joe Biden. It's actually getting worse now. And then when you see coming back domestically, when you see things like the radical leftist agenda, these people are cultural Marxists.
Yes.
And they are using the LGBT rights community as a way to shoehorn in these radical theories. And you've got, you know, again, the Queers for Palestine. And I'm like, do you not understand that the only place in the Middle East that has some sort of semblance of gay equality is Israel, and these are the people that you're protesting? It is astounding, and people are seeing it. We're seeing it in the polls. We're seeing, and this is why we as an organization are leaning into reaching out to center-right gays and saying, look, you have a place in the Republican Party. Donald Trump is somebody who has a long history of inclusion. And then also looking at people, to your point, around, you know, who have friends that are gay, suburban women and the youth vote. Again, suburban women, one of the toughest areas that the GOP has in this upcoming election. Our messaging around unity, equality, equal opportunity, not equal outcome, equal opportunity
is
something that resonates so well. And that's why, you know, it's very important that we have the resources to do the work that we do. And we do.
Yeah. Well, it was great. Charles Moran, thank you so much for joining us. You can follow him at Charles T. Moran. And the First Lady is hosting an event for them coming up, which I think is great. You know, Melania Trump, very quiet, very classy. And I could see where the gays would love her because she has a wonderful wardrobe. But I love that she's doing a fundraiser with you guys. And I love that you're getting the word out that just because, you know, the Democrats expect you to vote for them, and that's just the way you've always done it, doesn't mean you have to continue to do so, and it's all about education. So good job. Charles Moran, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
866-408-7669. Your call's coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
And I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade today. 866-408-7669 is my number. I want to change gears and just talk a little bit. Since we were just talking to Charles Moran from the Log Cabin Republicans, and traditionally, you know, the gay community has always voted Democrat. They vote liberal. We're very liberal, and they vote Democrat. And that's changing. And the same thing in the Black community, the Hispanic community. You're seeing people say, my vote isn't going to be taken for granted anymore. And another group in which that is happening, Gen Z. Gen Z, the young voters there, seem to be moving more towards becoming more conservative. And I think part of that is normal. The pendulum goes so far, and then it swings back the other way, right? It comes back the other way. And the New York Post did an interview with four Gen Zers. And one of them, a young woman who said, she said, when I was a teenager, I was emotional, I was hormonal, I was an angry little girl. And she was very left. She was a radical feminist. And she said, you know, I was fighting against power structures, and her parents weren't super political. But she said her upbringing, and this is important, was dominated by left-wing messaging from school to peers and the internet. She said, I was your typical Tumblr leftist, and I was raised on gender theory through social media. Take this a step further. All these studies that are coming out, there was one that came out from Germany about 2 weeks ago that shows these kids who are transgendered. They're transgendered and they're teenagers, and it all happens in middle school, right? It's all in middle school when the hormones are raging and you hate your body and you hate life in general, because those years are tough years. They're really hard years. They grow out of it. She said, I was 15 when Donald Trump won. She was devastated. I spent the whole day crying because I was so scared. But now, in 24, she's voting for Trump. And listen to this. She said, the whole orange man bad thing is very tired and very played out. And I think more young people are realizing that. And then she said, during the COVID-19 lockdown, something clicked for her. And she said the vaccine mandates, the Black Lives Matter protests, and the riots in 2020, said, I just started questioning everything. I started to get very exhausted by the constant anger. I guess I just started to mature as a person, and I started to realize that a lot of my reactions were based more on emotion than in fact. Yes, yes. It's so true. She got out of school. She's home during a COVID lockdown. And look at that. It was a breakthrough. And I've said for a long time, sorry, ladies, but liberal white women are the cause of most of the problems in this country. They really, truly are. You know, they're going to save all the Black people from not being able to get an ID. And they're going to fight for all the gay people. Stop it. Like, they're some kind of warriors. And Gen Z men are leaning conservative as well. You see a gender gap there. Now, the first girl who they interviewed is on the other side of it, because most Gen Z women are going towards becoming more liberal. Most Gen Z guys are becoming more conservative. And think about it. They've been raised their whole lives being told that, you know, your toxic masculinity, your white privilege, that's the reason why you get stuff. Nearly half of men ages 18 to 29 now say there is discrimination against them in American society. It's up double digits from 2019. And 53% of single men say they're reluctant to approach women for being seen as creepy. Like, they're so confused. Like, if I go up and talk to you, I don't want to get sent to the guidance counselor, sent to the principal's office because I asked you out. So men now, Gen Z men, are taking a step back in dating because they don't want to be swept up in these, you know, because Gen Z women are always complaining about the men. So they're just sticking to themselves. So, and they want a guy, these Gen Z women want a guy who's liberal, but is also an alpha male. Good luck. Good luck. You're not going to find it. So there's a gender divide among Gen Z. It's a very interesting generation, and I think we tend to write them off, you know, as you do, like every generation, as you get older, the more you write off the younger generation. But they're coming into a world where they really are behind the eight ball financially. A lot of it has to do, yeah, with their student loans, and they made some poor choices in majors, that kind of thing, yes. But they're the first generation to graduate into an economy where if you have a college degree, you're not getting jobs. But if you went to trade school, you're getting jobs. So they're the first generation to graduate into that. Add to it, as we were saying with Michael Goodwin earlier this hour, you know, the dollar doesn't go as far, so things cost more, and you're not making as much. Excuse me. Their wages aren't increasing to keep up with it. I mean, none of us are, right? So it's a tough mix that they're coming into. So maybe we shouldn't be so hard on our little Gen Zers and maybe cut them a break. But it could be good because it could be forcing them to wake up and vote for Trump, becoming a little bit more conservative. So that's a good thing. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
And welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. How are you? I am Mary Walter sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. You can hit me up on X at Mary Walter Radio. And on Tuesday, so tomorrow, you can catch my podcast. It is live on YouTube and Getter. Just look for Mary Walter Radio, 7:15 p.m. Eastern time, and it's interactive. You can leave comments and questions, and we always have a fun guest. And then the audio is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Again, look for Mary Walter Radio. Joining me now, Jeff Flock, Fox Business correspondent. Find him on X at Jeff Flock. That's easy. Jeff, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. How are you?
I'm good, Mary. Good out here looking at mortgage interest rates and new houses.
So I'm very interested in what's going on in the housing market. I think when you live in the New York City area, you're somewhat insulated from the ups and downs of the market because people are moving out of Manhattan to flee everything they voted for. And so they're moving to the surrounding suburbs, much to our chagrin. However, they do pay a ridiculous amount of money for the homes, and they think that the taxes are reasonable, which I find interesting. So what is what's happening though in the bulk of the country? I think the areas around cities, you see that a lot happening, but for the bulk of the country, that's not happening. Is housing slowing down everywhere finally, and is that a good thing?
Yeah, with respect to certain markets, certainly it is. But, you know, housing is very difficult to gauge on a national basis because everything, as you point out, is very different depending on where you go. I mean, if you look at Arizona, places that people are moving to, you know, things continue to boom. But right now, nationwide, the one thing you can say pretty much across the board is there's a lot of problems with inventory. People are just not putting their houses on the market, and consequently, you got a lot of people competing for a very small number of homes, and that drives the prices up.
We just had that conversation we were at a neighbor's house. There were three neighbors, and we tried to get together, and we were at their house, and we were all talking about how we're all getting contacted by real estate agents. You want to sell your house? You want to sell your house? You want to sell your house? Or, hey, would you like to rent your house? And for insane amounts of money. But then we're like, well, where do we go? Right? Because you're going to spend an insane amount of money for overinflated price for a different house, unless you downsize. But even then, you're still paying an inflated price. So how do you break that cycle?
Well, what's caused this largely is the interest rates. You know, you've just taken a lot of people out of the game. And it's just a weird kind of, you know, confluence of factors. As you point out, you can, if you decided to go and sell your house right now, if you're old like me, maybe you had your house paid off. And so you're going to come away with some cash, and then you can become a cash buyer. And these days, that's who's winning these battles for the very few homes that are out there. I mean, the poor guy is the guy and woman who, are a first-time home buyer who have a loan, have maybe not a great down payment. How do they compete with a cash buyer who's making a full-price offer? And so those are the guys being squeezed out. I mean, you and me probably, you know, we can afford to buy a home somewhere, even if we're downsized. But the first-time home buyer is really getting squeezed right now.
You know, and when it comes to the first-time home buyer, maybe I'm just a little skeptical. You know, I saw these 20-somethings, I can't buy a home. Sweetheart, I bought my first home when I was 39 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I think they want everything too fast.
Well, true, but I mean, I bought my first home actually when I was only 22, but I bought it with an 18% interest rate, which you may be too young to remember, but in 1980, 1981, that's what the interest rates were. And so, you know, you were taking a huge hosing there, and it took me years to recover from that disaster. But, you know, that's the way things are. So when I look at a 7% interest rate, which is where we are right now, it doesn't seem so bad. But again, you know, I'm looking at it from a perspective of an old guy.
Right. That's okay. We both are. Well, I'm looking at it from an old woman instead of an old guy. So I also want to ask you about something that happened during COVID, which is resort areas in the country, especially out west and also like in Florida and areas like that. You saw a lot of people flocking to Florida, flocking to other and resort areas where, wow, I can live in the Rockies and work remotely. This is awesome. And they were doing exactly what you're saying. Also, with the people, you know, leaving states like California and Oregon, and they're like, oh, I'm going to go settle out west. So a lot of people in this country have second homes, have vacation homes. And those were very hard to come by during the pandemic. And people were walking in, I've got $3 million cash, what can I buy? And buying in 24 hours. Is if those, because I've noticed a softening of those markets. I've been watching those. Hubby and I would love to, you know, pick up and move. And so we're looking. And I've noticed a softening with price decrease in some areas in Florida, some areas of Montana, Idaho, though, you know, Colorado, in those areas where it looks like people are starting to unload their second homes.
Yeah, I think there's two factors there. One, yeah, you know, it seems like a cool idea, but it's like buying a boat sometimes, you know. The happiest day is when you bought it, and the second happiest day is when you sold it. You realize that it's more maintenance and more upkeep and more to it and more cost than maybe you thought. And I think that's true of second homes as well. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of the employers, they were open to this whole work remote idea for a while. That's kind of pulling back a little bit. And, you know, I've talked to several people who, you know, the company said, oh, yeah, okay, you can work remotely. And then they said, know what, you need to come back to the office. Well, sorry, I moved to Utah. Well, you know, if you want your job, you're coming back to your office in New York or, you know, Philadelphia or wherever you actually started out. So there's that problem as well. And, you know, I think that's putting the squeeze on those markets, which seem very attractive. And, yeah, it's great to live out there in the middle of nowhere. Nobody bothers you out there. But yeah, I think there's a downside, and that's what we're seeing in those markets.
So for people who are just sitting on their homes right now because they don't want to move, hence there's no inventory as we started this conversation out. There's not a lot of inventory on the market, and people with cash are the ones who are winning. So young people are being squeezed out of even starter homes now. It's impossible to get a starter home. Is this something where you just say, hey, sit tight, this is going to change? It has to change, doesn't it? The bubble has to burst somewhere.
Well, that's the great thing about the markets is, you know, it's a supply and demand issue. And, yeah, the prices are high now, but we're starting to see an uptick. We just saw the latest, in the latest report, unsold homes. That's starting to tick up, too. Now, those homes tend to be in not tremendously favorable neighborhoods. They're also, you know, homes that maybe need a lot of work and that sort of thing. So those homes have been sitting there because the buyers don't want those. But, you know, those prices come down, and then maybe some of those first-time home buyers can get in on a place like that. And so I do think the market will correct, and maybe we'll see a decline in interest rates. So that makes people, you know, a position where they can afford more. And maybe that's the way it goes. That's the great thing about the markets.
Yeah, no, I know. But I feel badly for people who are trying to time it properly, because it's hard to time it because you don't know. I know people who are selling their homes now because they're afraid of a Biden presidency, that it's all going to go south, and that they're not going to get what they could for their home now if interest rates ever correct. Janet Yellen is participating in a roundtable with CEOs in Minnesota. And are we going to see any kind of adjustments in rates? What's going on there with all of that? I mean, everyone wants the feds to lower the interest rates to kickstart the housing market, but they're not doing it.
Yeah, I think the Fed's in a tough position. They're, you know, lowering at this point. You got to really be careful with that because we saw what they've already been through, and not raising maybe when they should have sooner. And now we, you know, in this inflationary spiral, the administration tends to try and help people out when they're in, you know, when they can't afford stuff like student loans and that sort of thing. But that doesn't necessarily correct the imbalance in the market. And so I'm not sure what she's going to announce. You're right. She's in Minnesota today. And the headline is, they say she's going to talk about what the administration is doing to bring down housing costs. There's not a whole lot you can do unless you want to, go in with a gun at the Fed and force them to lower. The interest rates are what they are. I think I just checked before we went on, and we're looking at nationwide about 7.3%, which, you know, that's the other thing that's really driving this is if you've got I don't know what your mortgage is or if you have one, but, you know, a lot of people have a 3% mortgage and makes it awful hard to go back in at 7.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a disconnect. We keep hearing from the administration, it's true, Wall Street, we keeps hitting highs, Wall Street's doing great, but yet people can't afford stuff. It's a total disconnect in my brain.
I have to say, and I tend not to be, you know, overly conservative, but I will say this, that this gap between those who have and those who do not, there's different questions or ideas about what to do about that. But I think everybody agrees right now, yes, some of the guys on Wall Street, not to paint them with too broad a brush, but those that are doing well are doing really well. And those that are not doing well are really struggling right now. And I think that is the disconnect that we're seeing. Yeah, the economy in some ways, you know, my 401k is doing pretty well. But if you don't have a 401k and you're living hand to mouth, not so much. And, yeah, it's reasonable to think that those who worked hard and were successful do a little bit better. I think that gap now has grown, and it's particularly visible in the housing market. And what do we do about that? You know, I leave that to the political folks to try and come up with a solution for. But I think there's no question there's a disconnect there, and it's a problem.
Yeah, leaving it up to the political folk is going to just make the problem that they got us into worse to begin with. I don't know what a great idea that is, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I would probably screw it up worse even than them, but something needs to be done. Somebody needs to figure something out here.
Exactly. Jeff Flock, thank you so much for joining us. Follow him on X at Jeff Flock. Thank you. Have a great day.
Very great to talk to you. See you
as well. 866-408-7669. Housing and the economy. There's a disconnect. You can look at your 401k and go, yes, it's doing really well, but I'm having a hard time making ends meet. It can happen. And housing, you're trying to buy a house? You're trying to want to sell your house? What are you doing? I'll take your calls coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's more about the future than the past. So some of the issues you just detailed are historic in nature and in some cases long forgotten. The challenge for the administration currently is that inflation has really hurt on food prices. They're up 30% since pre-pandemic on housing and energy. That's not going away. And for the average American who doesn't care what the stock market's doing, that is a big debate. Border security, also huge. Foreign affairs, every day in the news, whether you're pro or con, whichever side. These are big debate issues.
That's Kevin O'Leary, Mr. Wonderful, on the Ingram Angle, talking about housing and energy costs. And we were just speaking with Jeff Flock. Now, he was outside of a home in New Jersey. That home sold within 4 days of listing. But again, as we said, you know, in those areas outside of metropolitan areas like New Jersey, houses are selling super quickly. They're selling very fast. because people are leaving New York because they want to get to New Jersey. They want to get to Connecticut. They want to move further away from the city in the state of New York, what they call upstate. But even though, you know, Westchester County is not really upstate. So those homes are not sitting on the market real quick. They're selling within 4 days. The average, the median house price is now sitting at $419,300. It's a lot of money. And there's a lot of kids, people who are saying, not even kids, but people are saying, I can't afford that. So they're perpetual renters. We rented until I was 39 years old. I rented, you know, whether I wasn't living with my parents and when I was living back with my parents, they charged me rent. And, you know, when I got married, my husband and I, you know, moved a couple different places and we rented the whole time. But we saved up so that we could make a nice big down payment and we could get the kind of house we wanted. And that's what we did. I quickly want to go to Mike in Florida. Mike, you're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Good morning, Mary.
How are you?
Not good.
What's the matter? Go ahead. We don't have a lot of time, though.
Yeah, no. What happened, see? I've been seeing a lot of programs, podcasts with Patrick Bet-David, and all of these guys, and I'm not talking about what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years with housing, with all those millions of migrants coming through. Nobody's
true.
Talking about the cost to the economy on the long term. Nobody.
That's, you know, that's an excellent point. Mike, not to interrupt you, but that's a great point because what's happening is rents are going up because the government is taking these places, rental buildings, and they're kicking the renters out and they're putting the illegals in, and the government pays whatever they want because it's your money. So it's artificially raising the price of rent.
Some places around the world that could not happen because the people are so aware. They're so aware. People in America here, they are dumb, man. They are really dumb. They don't listen to programs.
You know, Mike, I don't think that they're necessarily dumb, but I do think there's a bit of Not information. They're ignorance because for most Americans, unless you live in a city, you're not really seeing the problem. So it's really only people in the city that are really seeing this. Like you see in Chicago when people are yelling about, you know, my kid's field now has tents on it that has people, illegal immigrants living in it, and they're getting all this stuff. Or this hotel that used to be a really nice hotel in New York is now full of illegals, and they're here and they're, you know, getting all this money and they're getting the cards. They have the refillable cards. And they're getting $5,000 a month and all the food that's getting thrown out. So they see these people getting more than them. But if you live in the suburbs, if you live in the vast majority of this country, you're not seeing that. So I think that there's a disconnect in that way. Yeah, we know there's a lot of people coming across the border illegally. Yeah, we know that there are particularly women and young girls who are being kidnapped, raped, assaulted, killed by these people. And, you know, because in their country, this isn't a problem. But here it is. And it all ties in together. This idea of the government coming in and taking hotels and also taking housing buildings, apartment buildings, taking over entire apartment buildings. They're so desperate to house these people because they have their, you know, sanctuary city policies. So they're so desperate to house them. They'll take an entire building and they go to the owners of the building. They're like, hey, I know you're getting $1,000 a month for the studio apartments. We'll give you $1,500 a month, but, you know, it's all, we're putting all these people in there. So, of course, the people who own the building, they're in business. I can't blame them. They're like, fine, out with everybody else. And then they take the illegals in, and they're getting more money from the government. And they can raise the rent as much as they want because the government has bottomless pockets. It's called you. So Mike is absolutely right that has a trickle-down effect. So those people now have to try to find some place to live. And so they're forced to pay more in rent as well. So they're never going to save enough money for a house. So he's right. Until it happens to you, I think we're just not aware of it. Like, we know it's a problem and people don't like it, but financially we're not really feeling it yet. If you live in an area where maybe the hospital's going out of business because they're treating so many people illegally, yeah, you start to feel it, you start to see it. But until then, we don't. So I don't know if it's ignorance. I don't know. I guess maybe peace, you know, blissfully ignorant that way. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade, but I want to say a big welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show, KAOI, 1110 AM and 96.7 FM, right in the morning, left in the afternoon, news, talk, and sports from Maui. So welcome. I don't know, guys. I'm seeing a Brian Kilmeade Show station visit off to Maui with everybody, and I'll carry your luggage because I want to go too. That's fantastic. So talking about the economy, I was speaking with Jeff Flock, and he was, you know, he's in New Jersey, and, you know, home was sold within 4 days of listing. So that's great. But I think in other parts of the country, that's not happening as much if you're not outside of a metropolitan area where people are coming from inside the big city who have a lot of money and they want, you know, a little bit of property. They want to get out of the big city. They have cash and they show up and they've got a lot of money. They pay cash for it. And of course, that takes out all the people who need to get a mortgage. And getting a mortgage is expensive now. A lot of people are sitting and waiting for mortgage rates to go down. So it's almost like a dog chasing his tail, right? It's going round and round and round. And nobody can afford anything. So nobody's moving. Nobody's investing. As a matter of fact, here's Donald Trump talking about the economy.
When I left office, inflation was practically nothing. During my term, we had gasoline down to $1.87 a gallon, and at some points, even less than that. And the 30-year mortgage rate was 2.7%. And then Joe Biden blew it to shreds. Biden's inflation, price hikes, and energy destruction have cost the average American family an astounding $28,000. $28,000, that's a lot of money. And with me, they actually made $16,000. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. And I also want to go to this as well. This is Jessica McCabe on Fox and Friends. This is a flashback to about this time last year, August of 2023. And talking about, she's an Alabama mother of two, talking about her kids, they're doing the right thing and they can't get ahead.
It's not 1988 anymore. We have to, as parents, realize that the economy has changed. I understand inflation. Prices always go up. But I think that lately the wages are not keeping up with how big the inflation has gotten. I went out yet again with my son to go try to find an apartment he can afford. And we just kept getting backdrops or backs. Half the places I felt like should have been condemned that he could afford. And the other half, they were wanting four times your rent. They wanted you to show that you can make four times that. And I hear all the other Gen Zs and millennials in my comments saying that they finally feel seen, because I think us as Gen X, we forget that it's not the same as it is now for our kids. And we think, well, we did it, so they should be able to, too. And we need to be their advocate. I didn't have kids to watch them suffer their entire life.
To her point, though, how many of us had roommates when we first started out? I did. My brothers did. When we had our first apartments, we had roommates because we couldn't pay for it all on our own. So, you know, you get an apartment for four, like we did. You have an apartment, two bedrooms, and we put more than one person in a room sometimes, or somebody slept on a couch or on a hide-a-bed couch or a mattress, you know, on the floor, whatever. It wasn't the prettiest thing in the world. But you did what you had to do. I had no furniture. I had zero furniture. I was living in Fort Worth, Texas, far southwest Fort Worth, Texas, out by TCU. And I knew nobody. So I had befriended the bank teller. And we're still friends to this day. And we were in each other's weddings the whole bit. So she and I got an apartment together. Because she was spending rent, I'm spending rent, and neither one of us could afford it. So we pooled our resources, and it was cheaper to get a two-bedroom apartment, and both of us paid for it than it was to each of us have our own apartments. Because you're paying for one kitchen with two people, you know, and one living room with two people. We each had our own bathrooms, two-bedroom, two-bath. But that's what we had to do. And maybe that's what has to happen. And I don't think that's a terrible thing to get roommates. My brothers did it. My brothers had, it was a revolving door where they lived. They have their friends, this one, that one, anybody they could get to help pay the rent. I don't think that's a terrible thing. Is that not doable? 866-408-7669. You can reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. Let's go to Anita in Dayton, Ohio, listening on WHIO. Anita, welcome.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. I'm good. Hey, I'll tell you, we're a little aggravated here in the Midwest. My daughter just graduated from nursing school debt-free because we saved. She worked. And so now she has no savings because it's all been into college. And she's paying over $1,000 a month in rent with a roommate. And to look for a house, you know, she has no savings because she put it all into her education. So to get a 20% down payment on a house that's sorely overpriced, you know, we really don't want her to have to come back home. But dang, you know, she doesn't qualify for any of the free stuff because she doesn't have the right kind of debt, you know.
Right.
So it's a little aggravating.
Well, that's the thing is she should just not have paid it. And then, you know, if you haven't paid it for 10 years, don't worry. It's on the taxpayers. And she's going to get to pay for other people's debt now. That's going to be her reward for being responsible. Is guess what? You get to pay for, you know, people who are working for the government, et cetera. You saw that story, I'm sure, of the staffer who leads a very extravagant lifestyle and he loves to post about it. And he got his loans forgiven. "Quote unquote forgiven,"
yeah.
You know, we're paying for it. But so here's the thing: I moved home. To me, there's no shame in moving home. I moved home after college. And then I went out. My first job, I had to live in. Like I said, I was living in Fort Worth, Texas, and then I quit that and I moved back east. I moved back and I lived with my parents again, but I paid them rent.
Yeah.
Now the rent I was paying was not what I would have paid if I had, you know, been living on my own. And so they charged me a small rent, but I was paying off my student loans and I lived with my parents and I got married and I, you know, went and I lived with my husband and we rented until I was almost 40 years old when we bought our first house. So
well, you do what you do. You do what you have to do. That's and we've always wanted more better for our kids than what we had. You know, so now, you know, here their friends are getting their stuff written off and whatever. And you know, she just kind of looks at us like, gee, thanks. And so it's aggravating.
Get it. To me, that is outrageous. And that to me would be so maddening. On the other hand, she's a good Republican voter now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
and she understands that. That's you know, I mean, and she was a high school graduate of 2020. So. You know, she did end up in a better place than what she would have had she had her first choice of things. But she's better for it. And that's what I keep telling her.
Yeah, she is. That's sad, Anita. Thank you for sharing that. That is something that really gets me so angry. I'm more angry at that than, you know, prices are high, that kind of thing. This girl did the right thing, and this is where our country is right now. They're going to do it with Social Security and Medicare. If you're responsible and you saved and you made really good investments, they're going to go, you can pay for your own health care. You have the money. Sell your vacation home. You are responsible. Responsible people are getting hurt, and irresponsible people are being rewarded. That's not the way the system's supposed to work, people. And when it happens to you, it's soul crushing. I can understand. If that were me, and I see the train on the tracks. I'm sure it's going to happen to me. I'm sure when it's time for Social Security, when it's time for Medicare, they're going to look at me and go, "So, got some bad news. Good news, you were super responsible. You lived below your means your entire life," which my husband and I have, still do. And so, you know, the vacation home you wanted to buy, you know, you were going to, you know, have a little place to ski, that kind of thing. Yeah, not so much, because that's what you're going to pay, you know, you used to pay for your medical care. Oh, and no Social Security. Sorry, ran out. That's what's going to happen. All right, I've got a lot of calls here. We're going to get some more of your calls coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Mary Walter in for Brian Kilmeade. Jim hit me up on X and says, looking into moving from Michigan to Marion County, Florida. The mortgage and housing interview was very helpful and informative. Good. I'm glad. A lot of people moving to Florida. I have to say, we were there in April last year. In Naples, our neighbors bought a home there, and they were kind enough to invite us down, thinking that we'd never take them up on the offer. And surprise, we did. So we went to go visit them, and they put up with us. It's hot. It's hot. It was hot in April. The air conditioning's on in the house in April. What is it like in August? I mean, I get it, the taxes, and it's beautiful. I mean, where they are is absolutely stunning. stunningly beautiful. It's crazy. It's like living in a resort, right? Year round. But the heat, even in April, I don't know if I could do that year round. Speaking of Florida, let's go to Orlando. Steve on WDBO. Steve, how do you do it in August?
We have a lot of air conditioning.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah, I'm in the yard space.
Oh, Steve, your phone is all messed up. So I'm going to put you on hold and I'll come back to you. So don't go anywhere. Mary Lee in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You are on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, Mary. You were saying you're thinking about moving and looking around. And
yeah.
Of course, I think south of Tulsa is beautiful, and Jinx and Bixby and all that. But I have a place. Have you ever thought of the Branson, Missouri area? The smaller towns, they've got gorgeous homes over the cliffs and everything. And, of course, you got Table Rock Lake. And my daughter, who lives in Ozark, Missouri, built a home in Kimberly City. People are buying these lots, and they're moving in. They're executives from Microsoft and all that. But that's a beautiful area. And another beautiful area is Mountain Home, Arkansas, that's on a huge lake.
We haven't really looked south. My husband is under the delusion that at 70, 75 years old, he's still going to be skiing. And maybe he will be. So he really, we fell in love with Montana in 04. And now since, you know, California and Oregon have vomited into Montana, we started looking at Idaho. And they're going there too. So it's a bit, but it's not as bad in Idaho. But he wants to be somewhere where he can do something. Like, we live at the Jersey Shore now. So we have the shore. Not that we ever get to the beach, because we're always doing, we always have guests and we always have so much going on. We never get to the beach, even though it's right there. We never get there. But he wants to, I think what he would love to do is live out west to ski and then come back to Jersey for the summer. I just don't think we're going to be able to afford it, to be perfectly honest with you.
I have friends in Missoula, Montana, and they have a house on Flathead Lake.
Oh, yes.
And so the house taxes are outrageous. But anyway, they have a beautiful house on Flathead Lake if you want to buy it.
Yeah. Well, we've been to Flathead Lake. We have friends who have a home on Flathead Lake, too. The problem with Flathead Lake is it never gets warm enough to actually swim in. It's really cold.
I know it doesn't. I know it doesn't.
It's beautiful, but you don't want to go in it. Mary Lee, thank you so much. I appreciate the suggestions. And we just never looked in that part of the country. We're just starting to look, and we've never really looked there. We just always thought we were going to go to Montana. And then with COVID and the show Yellowstone, suddenly everybody wants to go to Montana now. So I was like, ugh. There are more man buns and skinny jeans in Bozeman, Montana than I think probably in like Berkeley, California. Steve in Orlando, let's see if you got a better signal here. Steve, welcome back.
Okay.
Yeah, yay!
You're talking about the interest rates. The opposite is true for me, because we got an interest rate fixed in 93, I believe, for 2%. Mm-hmm. And we can't do anything. We can't get a home equity loan. We can't do anything because we're going to be paying a higher interest rate.
Ugh. Yeah, that's right. You can't even get a HELOC. You can't do that.
I haven't looked into that, but I know that a home equity was, we tried it, but we're going to be paying a higher interest rate with that.
Right. But if you're invested in the market right now, you're making more in interest than you're going to be paying out in a HELOC right now. So it's worth it to just get the HELOC, and you're going to pay it back. Yeah, you may be paying at a higher rate, but it's still less than what your money is making in the bank.
Yeah, we're paying our mortgages at our fixed mortgages at 2% for our house.
All right, no one likes a show off. I would look into it. I mean, you got to think about other people's money is great. OPM. And yeah, you have to pay an interest rate. The interest rate may be higher than what you're paying for everything else right now. But if you want to do it to get work done in the house or whatever it happens to be that you want the HELOC for, you can. It's still going to be more cost effective than taking your money out of the market at this point in the game, I would think. You know, I'm just spitballing here. I'm not a professional, but it would seem to me like that would be the way to go. Very interesting. Steve, thank you for joining me. And very quickly, let's get Brett in Virginia in here. Brett, welcome.
Hey, Mary, I just wanted to say I really liked your segment earlier about Gen Z. I'm a late millennial, born in 95, also a military veteran. So there are some of us out there that exist, 20-somethings that do love our country and want to serve. And since I've gotten out in September, I'm now a private school teacher. So to touch on that, just imagine that your Gen X parents are feeding you all this stuff of you can do whatever you want, you can achieve any dream, pursue right. any degree. And then all of a sudden, because I went to college before I joined the military, and I was a total crazy lefty. And then all of a sudden, when you get into the real world, when I joined the military, the real world will kick your butt. And if you are going to hold on to that lefty ideology from college, it's not going to serve you well. And I'm just going to tell you that.
No, that's very true. That's very true. And thank you for your service. Having grown up towards the liberal side, what made you go into the military?
Probably mostly being from the Hampton Roads area, born and raised,
okay.
just seeing
yeah.
Navy everywhere I went. And I've
right.
always wanted to serve. Both of my parents were teachers, and I come from a family of teachers and military. So that's all I know and all I want to do.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for sharing your story, because I think you're right. I think when you get into the real world, sometimes you need a good kick in the butt, and that's what it does for you. One more quick story here. Did you know, I just saw this breaking news. It's an exclusive in the Daily Mail. Dr. Fauci is still getting a taxpayer-funded security detail and SUV, even though he retired a year and a half ago. Why? Why is Dr. Fauci still getting that? He has an estimated net worth of $11 million. No matter where he goes, gym, TV, studios, wherever, he's constantly surrounded by U.S. Marshals and in the government SUVs. According to the Daily Mail, at least six U.S. Marshals were seen with a fleet of vehicles parked in his neighborhood, ready for whenever he leaves his property. His property is worth about $2.2 million. Their marshal pin badges are clearly visible. They are on call all times of the day for when he needs to travel. According to, who is this? Rand Paul. Rand Paul said the only other person probably getting his level of security would be the president, the vice president, maybe cabinet members, and a few members in leadership in the House and Senate. And he's getting this when he isn't in the government anymore. Why? Why are we paying for this? The sainted Dr. Fauci. I'm Mary Walter, and you're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.